our heritage is one of celebration, and there's a richness to it that we have taken for granted.
Yeah,
and I want to use this as an opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah. So I will, I mean, if we start talking about Ajdadi, I go into that a lot. And and also, I mean, I call it sometimes Palestinian washing. Mm. You know, by slapping on something saying we're Palestinian, it doesn't stop there. And no batikha, okay, great. Those are the symbols that, you know, Sulaiman Hurani and Salman Mansur came up with. But are they just the symbols that we want to be represented by? But you know, our history and identity is so rich.
It is rich.
We could have started this.
Yeah, we could have. Yeah. No way! Amazing! Fazirin! Hi, everyone. I'm Dana Al-Hanbali, and this is Something to Consider. My next guest is a special one. And to mark the occasion, he's actually brought in his own tea and sage. This is definitely not a regular interview. I met this person at an event celebrating the heritage of Palestine very, very recently. And I fell in love with the way that he so poignantly articulated his love for our culture and our heritage in a way that I feel like we don't do enough of. A lot of the time when it comes to celebrating our identity and our history, it comes from a place of pain, when really it should be part of our everyday and our everyday in everything that we do. And I felt like it was the perfect kind of opportunity to kind of bring him on the show and have a conversation about what he does and his thoughts on culture, heritage, and identity. So I'd like to welcome Ishaq Jarallah, or Zach. أهلين أهلا وسهلا.
Thank you very much. والله شرفتينا. Thank you.
والله أنت اللي شرفتنا. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I love what you're wearing.
Yeah, thank you. So لازم الكوفية, of course, as part of the representation. I've been wearing the كوفية actually for the last 2 years, 3 years, nonstop, since 2021, the events of Sheikh Jarrah. And after that, I basically said, why don't we be unapologetic about our Palestinian identity and be bold in our representation? And so, yeah, I wear it. It almost makes me stand a couple of feet taller, right? So that, and then I'm wearing a abaya from a repurposed thob. It's an antique thob that I bought from the old city of Jerusalem. This is that as well.
I absolutely love it.
Thank you very much.
I usually start the episodes with a question about that gives the audience a little bit of context about your life.
Sure.
So what context do we need to know about your life, the way that you grew up, who you are, where you come from, to get a little bit of an understanding about you?
Sure. So first of all, I'm Ishaq Jarallah. Nice to meet you. I am a Palestinian. Both my parents are from Jerusalem. So I'm also from Jerusalem. I grew up in a very classical Palestinian household where news was always on television. We were always watching the news. We were always growing up in that environment, understanding what's happening, but also in a spectrum or in some sort of a way, there was a bit of a censorship or a silence that we couldn't talk about certain things or not so obvious about our Palestinian identity. So as I grew up older, this sort of concept was challenged through my life. I grew up most of my life here in the UAE. And of course, with family in Jordan and Palestine, doing regular trips, being able to visit from that aspect as well. I studied in the UK, so I had also the spectrum of being access to sort of the broader world, see what the West thinks of us also as an identity. And then I've come back to work here in the UAE. And I live in Dubai. I work as my full-time job is I'm a management consultant and amidst a huge multinational Big Four consulting. And I'm also the founder and owner of my own clothing brand called Ajdadi Collective, which is a social enterprise. And it combines the whole concept of Tatriz with streetwear, in a Tatriz streetwear concept.
Inshallah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a question that kind of begs itself. You work at a multinational conglomerate and you've been wearing the kufiya for the past 3 years?
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I have the way I wear the kufiya, I sort of integrate it into my suit as well. I typically wear a three-piece suit to work. And so how does it fit with the three-piece and my tie? And I also wear a map of Palestine as a tie-pin as well. And, you know, I would go as far as to say what you see here is what you see in the office. I have gone to the office wearing this abaya, this bisht as well. But yeah, I mean, initially there's some questions, but this goes back to what our role is and how do we want to celebrate our identity and our culture and being unapologetic and being bold. And why should we sort of censor ourselves or oppress our voice by not being able to wear, you know, a symbol of our national identity? So yeah, there is initially some backlash. There is initially some commentary. There are clients who, you know, when you first walk into a client office and you're wearing it, they're like, okay, well, how do we take this? Where do we go from here? But I think that's part of it. And that raises the questions where you can have then an opportunity to educate others and raise awareness, amplify Palestinian voices. And as I said, there's a confidence that we should have about wearing it. And let us celebrate that confidence.
I absolutely agree. And I admire that your ability to do that. But I think what makes you doing this even more important is while it may have started out of wanting to make a statement of asserting your identity in these spaces, I think what's more important is kind of staying true to who we are and embracing who we are. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about now when I sport my kufiye, the fact that it means more to me than just making a statement to the world, a statement that is being seen as rebellion. No, it's actually much deeper than that. Talk to me about why you started to wearing it.
Yeah, so I think just to go back onto your point, there is a fine line between sort of celebrating identity and appropriation. And I think there's a lot of people who somehow they misconstrue that and they say, oh, well, you know, making a statement or being bold unnecessarily. But when it is part of our culture, I mean, the kufiya has always been long part of our identity throughout the Levant, through the Gulf, through everything. And the black and white kufiya, sort of, I won't go into the history of its rise to prominence, but it has always become, let's say it's the second flag of Palestine. It's always become a symbol of our identity.
Please go into the history.
Symbol of our resistance. I mean, in the Great Arab Revolt, before, you know, under sort of the initial starting of the British Mandate, they replaced the fez, the tarbush, for kufiya to allow this sort of common identity as well. Of course, also the way the agal was worn, the story and the message of the agal with the shmar, with the kufiya, with the hatta. So that's always been a key part of it. But as I said, a symbol of our identity. But later through, let's say, as Palestinians, through the ongoing struggle, through the ongoing occupation, what is a kufiya? What is a hatta, a black and white one? Red and white one, what does that represent as well? And I'll never forget, I once wore it into a client office and there was a one of the Australian clients that I was dealing with, and she said, oh, you know, Zach's wearing a psychedelic scarf. And I said, no, sorry, this is actually a symbol of our, yani, Ramz al-Muqawama wa Nidal al-Sha'b al-Falastini, the symbol of our identity and our resistance. And I was going into the details of it, and you know, what white people or Western world is exposed to as part of this identity of the kufiya is that, you know, you're in the desert, you're going camping, that sort of thing. But when you sit and you explain it, and, well, what does it mean? Why is this a part of our identity? 2 weeks later, she comes in, she's wearing a herbawi kufiya from Al-Khalil, and she's saying, oh, I love it, and all of these things. And that's part of it, right? That's the platform of being able to educate. But the reason why I wear it is I want to be bold in my representation. I want to tell the world, I almost want to scream from the top of a roof to say, Ana Falastinia, and I don't care. And not for the sake of being Falastini, but what does it mean to be Falastini? You know, the strength, the symbols, the identity, the sumud, the muqawme. Yani, those are the very things weaved in the fabric of our Palestinian heritage, and our Palestinian identity. And we want to support those. We want to, like, wave them as a flag, you know. Of course, we don't have an ability to wave a flag, or we can't carry a flag with us everywhere we are. What's the next best thing? And the flag, the kufiya is our second flag. So yeah, that's why I wanted to wear it. And as I said, it does, when I started to wear it, it started to give me the strength, and it started to give me this, you know, I can be, and I talked about this before with you, I can be this professional Palestinian in my workplace and fully represent Palestine and still conduct business at the same time. Why should I have either or? And so carrying it into that space or going to a mall, I can combine streetwear with my kufiya. I can combine, you know, bring that identity of who I am as Zach with my Palestinian heritage.
This idea of asserting your identity always felt like it was something that would always come at a cost. Mm. And I find it interesting that you're drawing kind of the parallels of, you know, I can wear a kufiya and still be that professional Palestinian in the workplace. Well, of course you can. But I feel like, you know, and maybe you can relate to this, we all kind of grew up with with a shy understanding of what it means to assert our Palestinianness or our Arabness. And it was always to make sure that others were comfortable with it. It was always to make sure that we didn't upset the status quo by being to us in terms of the way that we represented our identity. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this goes back to what we were talking about in terms of what that household, that framework we grew up in. In a house, both my parents very sort of pro-Palestinian, very well read, and they understand the environment that they're living in as well. We still grew up with this spectrum of censorship. And I say a spectrum because it would start from everything, as my mom saying to me, Zak Habibi Khafif, you know, take it easy, slow it down, all the way to now, for example, with the recent events for my parents saying, no, don't post this, don't post that, right? So there is a continuous censorship. In the workplace, there's always been this taboo conversation around, do you bring in politics? And I think, and I always say this, us as Palestinians, we're forced into politics. We didn't want to be political. We want to live our life. We want to, you know, do that sort of day-to-day. Even if you speak to Palestinians now, they're not... The occupation is the overwhelming thing, but, you know, they want to have girl crushes. They want to go to the cinema. They want to... But we're always subjected to this, no, this is taboo. We're always almost in this defense mode of our identity and our heritage. And so that's where it ultimately gets to, that people try and put this framework or this roadblock to say, oh, it becomes political. This is part of the censorship that we've grown up with or that has manifested through our upbringing. And it's almost, how do we break that? How do we actually start to challenge and say, is this really taboo? Or are you just putting guidelines because you're avoiding the serious question or avoiding the topic on what identity is and how the right to represent sort of thing.
Or because the truth makes you uncomfortable.
Exactly, right? Yeah. To the point where people, they don't want to answer those questions or they don't want to engage with you in that topic. So I think that's also part of it. But how do we, us as a people, as a Palestinian, how do we break this shell to say, wait a minute, this isn't taboo? And there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
A lot of unlearning.
And unlearning and correcting the narrative and educating others. But I think it also starts with us as a conviction. And that conviction is all about how do we break the shell of that censorship that we are sort of brought up to as well.
My most recent experience with that has been using the right language and terminology. I always talked about the Palestinians outside of Palestine as the diaspora, when in reality, they are the exiled community. And I think calling it what it is the start of us coming to terms with the truth, however uncomfortable it may make people feel. Coming to terms with that truth is the first step to overcoming this shadow banning, a very relevant term to what we're dealing with right now, whether it be on social media or in public spaces when it comes to expressing ourselves. And I always found that calling any sort of expression of how we feel about Palestine or the Palestinian cause political was also another form of censorship in itself, because at the end of the day, humanity and fighting for equality shouldn't be a political conversation. This is a basic human right that everyone should be entitled to. So even the fact that kind of categorizing it as this political thing that this political topic that we need to avoid is a form of censorship that is imposed on us.
Yeah, correct. Sorry, just to add one thing there. I think what you touched on about the language and how we use it and the lexicon that we need to use, this is also what ties me back to that professional Palestinian. What gives us credibility to be able to talk about this? What gives us the topic, And it's not just language, but it's also reference of international law, pulling up Geneva Conventions, UN resolutions, calling out the hypocrisy and injustices that are happening, and almost being ready to have those difficult conversations with others, right? And yes, we talk about our strength as individual, but there is still this external environment where we need to be ready to confront and to have those difficult conversations. Practice debating with one another. Let's pull up the sort of the Hasbara commentary or the commentary that is always sort of neglected or silenced Palestinian voices and challenge that to be ready to be in those positions to have those conversations and make people feel uncomfortable. And I think you're 100% right. We need to call it what it is and reference it and term it and use the narrative to correct it, you know, correct the narrative that people understand this isn't just or land dispute, for example, or a religious war or something like that. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with religion. Yeah. But thank you for saying that, because you reminded me of actually a couple of recent conversations that I had to have with people. And I think what shocked me more than what I was hearing from people that let's call it, we're from the other side, or we're from the side that weren't empathetic to the Palestinians' fight. What made me more shocked than what I was hearing was how much I needed to educate myself on my own history. And as disappointing as that was, it was, I keep calling it an awakening, mm-hmm. an awakening of self, of understanding the context of we are where we are because we don't know enough about our story. You had an interesting story that you shared with regards to an experience you had in the workplace when it came to kind of asserting your right to express yourself. Would you be willing to share that?
Correct. So I will go into that, but I will say that I just wanted to touch on that point that you're making about this concept of awakening and doing the research. And I always say this, especially now, you know, there is a resurgence and those Palestinians who, yani bishitat, or living outside forced exile outside of Palestine, have now woken up and started to say we need to represent, as well as all the sort of allies and support that we have across other communities that are saying this injustice doesn't just apply to Palestine, but applies to us as a humanity. They have also turned and started to say we need to learn and we need to educate and represent. And I always say if we have a right to represent, we have an obligation to educate. There is this part of us which is saying, can we have those difficult conversations? Do we know our history enough to sit and to tell people? And it can stem from a very colonial mindset that people are saying, why are we educating others? They should pick up that book and they should read. And resources over the internet are incredible. And now through Instagram and TikTok, you can go through the history from 1917 all the way to 1948 and know everything that's going on, everything before the Nakba and the first Aliyah and next, all of this sort of stuff. But the reality is, do we as Palestinians have the background, the facts, the history to debunk myths, to challenge what the sort of pro-Hasbara discourse is saying? Do we have all the right information to leverage that discussion? So I think that's also important. So I'll get into now, say post-October 7, when it first happened, on LinkedIn. Mm. As a multinational organization, our colleagues from the other side, from our office in Israel had posted a comment saying, you know, the actions of October 7 are justified, and, you know, this whole sort of inflated language, it's, you know, on the brink of gaslighting. Yes, loss of human life is catastrophic at any level, but, you know, we do also recognize the gaslighting in that narrative, in that space. It's not historically, it's always been common and prevalent. And that was geotagged, it was reposted by Global and geotagged by Middle East. So now we have Middle East clients, as well as our Middle East office, being represented by a post done by our Israel office, while we still have offices in the West Bank, as well as offices in Jordan and a huge Palestinian population and representation within the firm. And so when we first started to sort of say, wait a minute, this doesn't represent us, through our diversity and inclusion policies, you're silencing our voices, you're not allowing us to represent ourselves, can the post come down? Or equally, allow us to have our voice. We're not even talking about equity at this point, you know, but we're saying equality, the most basic thing that this organization preaches is, how do we say you as a Palestinian group or community based in the firm can have a response to this post? We came together, we very quickly mobilized. I was actually very impressed by how all the Palestinians I knew were suddenly on a call. It was almost 300 of us. Across the firm. Wow. And we sat there going, well, what are our policies? What are diversity inclusion? What allows us to post on social media, LinkedIn policies, all of that? And we basically said the only way to do this is to prepare a form of signatures, and to take that to our senior leadership to say this needs to come down. And I talked about this in the call, that very quickly we saw how many allies we have. And I always say this, that Palestine and liberation of Palestine is at the crossroads of every social rights movement, whether it's LGBTQ, whether it's black communities, whether it's environment, whether it's women's rights, anything to do with equality. As fundamental as it is, Palestinians are demanding that same equality, right? So everyone, every minority group, every representation was pulling into this and very supportive of the signatures, and they were all signing. And then we were able to submit that to leadership. Now, there's still a lot of bureaucracy, especially within huge corporations that have headquarters in the US and follow certain laws and regulations. But at least it was this attempt to turn around and say, we're here. Mm-hmm. And our voice is still going to be heard. Khawa, yeah, we're here to represent ourselves and push back and to do this and to do that. Ultimately, the post from the Israeli member firm was removed as well. So anyway, we take a win where we can.
But
it's also as a message that we almost had 900 people signing that form. And that shows you how quick we can mobilize and support one another.
Absolutely. And for the right reasons, at the end of the day. What I love about this story and the reason I wanted you to reference it is I think that what we tend to do in situations that are very escalated and cause for escalated emotions, justified but escalated, sometimes difficult to control, is that we take decisions that rob us of an opportunity to be heard. And I think a lot of the time, walking away from the table does us more bad than good. And if we have a seat at the table and we have an opportunity to be heard, we have an obligation to speak. I love the way that you summed it up. If we have a right to represent, yeah, we have an obligation to be educated.
Yeah.
And I love that. I think that's so beautiful. What steps do you feel you have taken as a Palestinian? And you were born into this, but what steps have you truly taken that may help some of our listeners in terms of educating yourself on having conversations, these types of difficult conversations where you need to know your facts and you need to approach these conversations from a place of grace?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first thing is education, right? We need to understand our history as a Palestinian people, as well as the history of the occupation. What is our history? What is our identity? What is our culture? What happened before the Nakba? What were we like during the British Mandate? What were we like during the Ottoman rule? And having that gives us the foundations to say what of a type of a people we are, what that mindset is. Through then that next level of education, when we go through the history, of course, the history and the context of the occupation is essential. And I mean, in the sort of the pro-Israeli narrative that continues to come out is always decontextualizing Palestinians and our plight and our struggle as a people. And by removing that context, they can sort of leverage their narrative, etc. So what is our context? We need to understand the whole history of that context. And it is painful to go through some of the details, but I do suggest there are details to go into, right? Through Instagram, as I said, through social media, there's the whole high-level summary. But to understand the small levels of context that happened, let's say, before the Nakba, going into Plan Dalit that was executed for the full occupation of Palestine, what are the UN resolutions that happened in the time, and how did this all come together? The white papers that were being produced by, you know, UN figures and representatives in the British Mandate period, those give us the story of where we are here today. So that's one, I'd say educate. The second thing is understand our culture and our history. And it's so rich, and I'm sure we'll go into this in more detail, but what is Palestine in terms of an identity, a culture, our food, our lifestyle, our habits, our phrases to even some degree, you know, some sayings my mom says, I'm like, whoa, that's mad. How did you get that? So that's another thing. I always say if people have the opportunity to visit, it's essential. Seeing stuff on the ground is way different. Engaging in our films and our independent films is another way. We start to understand having conversations with other Palestinians. And I touch on that a little bit more just to say that it's not just about like coming together and sort of over-sympathize and play this victimhood. Yes, we are people of victim and we are enduring the occupation, but how do we come together to say, what is the next step? How do we break free from this? How do we push forward? Where do we go? How do we support one another? Our collective minds coming together, our skills, our attributes, you know, connecting through talks and podcasts, right? That's essential. Mm. Because bringing us together only makes us stronger, and that's key. The other thing is actually, and I said going there and visiting and being on the ground, but digging up archives, reading old stories, you know, the history and the written politicians and historians' context is essential. But, you know, read literary works of somebody talking about the Palestinian conflict, Hassan Kanafani stuff, Jal Tahti Shams, for example. I saw Ramallah, Ra'itu Ramallah. That sort of, those documents or those are artwork, our poetry, that all builds context. And then you realize actually that, you know, I've covered all grounds. I'm in a place where I can discuss and I can go through those conversations and challenge people. And the other thing which I find very valuable is making our cause relatable to others. Again, we talk about how we're always decontextualized or dehumanized in a certain way. But if our cause as a right to freedom, as a liberation movement, if it appeals to others, where does it fit? And I remember, you know, one of my former colleagues, very sort of feminist, very strong individual, very empowering women rights, all of this. And I had given her a book by Ahed Tamimi. It's called They Call Me Lioness. And I said, you know, this is just one of the stories in terms of where do we see Palestinian feminism in the overall spectrum of women's rights and globally, right? She was incredibly moved by it. And this is a very, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed Anglo-Saxon from the UK, knows nothing about the Middle East, reading about Ahed Tamimi. Incredible, right? So we need to also be able to find those connections with people. And through our access to all of the history, identity, culture, education, films, poetry, thaqafi, we can find what suits best for others to resonate with us.
Thaqafi.
Yeah.
Beautiful. We have a very, 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 very rich culture and heritage that goes beyond the delicious watermelon and beyond the incredibly delicious sage that you've brought us here today from Jerusalem. Talk to us about Palestinian culture.
It's so rich. I'm going to go into a little bit about my clothing brand because this is a
please do.
This is a moment of awakening, as we said, in terms of how understanding how rich it is. So my clothing brand, Ajdadi Collective, is a, first and foremost a social enterprise, but it combines Tatriz, traditional Palestinian style embroidery, with almost a lifestyle streetwear concept. So in this, the whole experience and the whole part of Ajdadi is to how do we empower and support Palestinian lives and communities through the work them as hand embroidering this the designs to celebrate their lives, to celebrate our culture, and more importantly, also our ancestry. And when I started this, when I started to think about, well, what is you know, my step in taking to the world my Palestinian identity and educating them and finding this common ground for solidarity for them to be part of our movement and our liberation struggle is through our culture. And as I designed the tatriz, and my grandmothers used to do tatriz, and this is why also the name Ajdadi comes into play, I started to look into the different motifs and patterns that come from the different areas of Palestine. And, you know, like we were saying before the call, the podcast, is that even in our identity, every area of Palestine, and Palestine is tiny, we're talking about 26,000 square kilometers, right? Mm. But for every area of Palestine to have different embroidery patterns, different motifs representing their landscape, their history, their agriculture, their livelihood, to then embroider it on a pattern or on a thobe, on their gowns, their dresses. And then for that to be sort of translated as a language between the different areas of Palestine is incredibly rich. And why is it on the back of the thobe, not on the front of the thobe, al-qubbe, al-banayik, mish al-kumme, mish... So it's incredibly rich. And as I started to design for Ajdadi, I sort of replayed some old conversations I had with the team who are based in Gaza, as well as with my grandmother. And I remember asking my grandmother, like, on what basis do you design? And she's like, man, it's all from my head sort of thing, where I pick a motif and I go for it type of thing. And I remember when I was designing, I spoke to my team who are based on the ground in Gaza, and I said, is there anything I should be mindful of or not to do? They're like, no. It's like, okay, so I choose my colors, I choose my motifs, I choose my placement, I choose everything. Like, yeah. It's like, whoa, there's a lot to do here. Mm. And our identity, and that's just tatriz. That's just, you know, when I, back into this whole space of clothing, and we talked about the watermelon is a crazy, incredible symbol of Palestinian identity, and its story of how it happened is also very valuable, and people need to understand, and how Salman Mansour and Salman Hurani, you know, made it as an icon. Same as Handala, for example, and Naj Al Ali. What the story of those are incredible. But now you see, for example, in you know, we Palestinianize stuff or Palestinian wash stuff. We slap a watermelon on it and we're good. But why not be more creative and push the boundaries of our culture and identity? And I always make this reference that we could make a whole clothing collection, like a full brand, just based on the olive harvest season. Mm. Just on olive harvest, the tools that we use, the language that people say, the behavior of al-fallaheen that used to go from village to village, the tabikh, the food that used to happen after the olive season, who's last to finish, invites everybody to the olive harvest to prepare it, how you would pick the olives, which ones are the ripe ones to pick. It's so rich at that space. And it's lost because it's also we're just focusing on, you know, a watermelon, or those are key items. Those are key symbols of our identity, especially the way they've been sort of amplified by the broader community. But we can talk about individual aspects of our culture and blow it up. And that's how we also keep our culture alive. Mm. If we just keep on focusing on handle, on watermelon, you know, Mabruk, those guys did it. They really elevated Palestinian art and culture. But why don't we find our own avenues to elevate new culture, new parts of our stuff that is hidden and forgotten or lost? Or, for example, Debke. Mm. Debke, we all know the sort of basic moves. But if you go into it, every area has its own Debke pattern. And why did they do this at what time and all of that stuff? Foraging, for example. You know, the picking of sage, miramiye, akub, za'atar, na'na. The history of understanding when is the season, the terms of these being built. That pulls us together. That was our Palestinian livelihood before the occupation. And that needs to be celebrated after the occupation, or at least during. Especially with this ongoing erasure of our identity. We need to find ways to uplift those pockets of our culture so they have a chance to grow and prosper as well.
Absolutely. That's so well said. And I was smiling the whole time because you painted such a beautiful picture of a world that I don't know. And it pains me to say this, but that is the reality of so many of these Palestinians that are in exile. So when we look at symbols, whether it's handala or the watermelon or the kufi, to an extent, these symbols, as overused as they may be, and they're always associated to resistance and fighting back, they gave us a very, very small language to be able to participate. But unfortunately, even these symbols have been weaponized and used against us. And, you know, to your point, we have so much history ingrained in the way that we are as a people that we can draw from. You know, I always wonder what it would feel like, especially because I grew up in the Gulf. And I love where I grew up. I consider it my home. But I always wonder how I would feel if I were to be in Nablus.
Yeah.
Would I feel different? Would I feel like I belong? How did it feel? Like, you've been there, right?
Yeah.
What happens to someone when they get there? Forget getting there. I know it's a challenge to get past the checkpoints and travel's horrible. I don't want to get into that. Tell me, what is it like when you're there?
I don't know. This is a deep one. I might get emotional, but look, there's nothing else. Like, most recently, I was there in last Eid. So it's almost, when was it? End of June.
Wow.
Yeah. And I had been there recently before then, but I'll just sort of talk about that. That there's a moment where you get your passport back and you're sort of allowed, you're given the green light to go in. And your first step outside of the airport. And of course, your luggage is gone and missing and whatever because you've been sat in a space for 3, 4, 5 hours. You've been asked annoying questions. You need to use the toilet. You're hungry or whatever. But the moment you step out and you're like, this is Palestine. And you're like, that's it. I'm home. The air feels different. Your body responds differently. You feel this like... this, you literally like were an inert sleeping cell that has suddenly come back to life and it breathes and it exists and it functions. And for me always, you know, Min al-Uds being from Jerusalem, the moment that really breaks my heart every single time I go back is when I see the Dome of the Rock, Qubbat al-Sakhra. And it sticks out, you know, despite whatever it is as considered in the sort of the occupations discourse, but the way it represents us as a Palestinian, regardless of religion, but us as a group of Palestinians, as a symbol of our sumud, our identity, our presence, our wujud bil-ard, you know, our on the ground, there it is, in its presence, in its magnificence. And you see the gold just shine off from the light and you're like, I'm here, I'm home. And that's something, it's absolutely incredible. And then you very quickly realize that, you know, yeah, there's still the occupation going around, but this is where you feel you should be. And you start to think, this is how would my life be? And you really want to move away from anything that would create you into a tourist, into something that would allow you to generate memories as fast as possible. I grew up listening to my mom's memories, to my dad's memories, to my aunts and uncles and grandparents, and I speak to my family there and they tell me, Zach, this is what's happening. I wanted to create my own memories as fast as possible. So everything from, you know what, I'm going to walk around, do nothing except smell, you know, fresh kaik coming from the streets, buy teen from Al-Bastat, from Bab Al-Amud, you know, the lady selling figs in Bab Al-Amud, Damascus Gate. I want to walk into the old city. I want to hear the, you know, the small toot of the garbage truck go by as they're picking up. And you want to generate and absorb all of these memories as fast as possible. And I'll tell you, they're so strong in my mind. And my mom always makes fun of me. And she says, Zach, you barely remember any holidays from France or when we go to Norway or whatever. I said, okay, that's all great. But I could tell you exact steps I can walk in the old city to go to, you know, to see my friends or to enter the Aqsa or to go to walk around the old city to visit my uncle's house. It's the exact memories, every stone you want to immortalize. You want to like press it to your face and hold it. And again, it's look, there's this romantic vision of Palestine. It is romantic to us. And you know, because of the stuff that we face and we suffer and we challenge, but there's still the ongoing occupation. You still also, there is some hostility that you're still received with other people. Some people are absolutely incredible. They say to you, A'idin, you know, that you've returned. You've come back and you're here. Props to you for coming back. Well done for enduring the stuff at the checkpoint. You're here now. Here are stories. And there's some people that say, well, you guys know nothing. You don't, you know, you haven't been around. You don't know what we go through. So that's the reality. And we do get caught in this sort of, we are, you know, we're welcomed by our people home, but we're not welcome home, you know, and how do we call this a home? How do we, and that's where I go back to, where do we create these memories and these beautiful things, these beautiful pockets? The other thing is very quickly you start to see that the occupation isn't just what we see in the news, but it's a day to day. You start to become part of that occupation, that people stop and arrest you or ask for your ID or don't allow you to enter Aqsa or you see other kids around you in your age, how they're restricted to do certain things. And you very quickly see, well, that stuff isn't televised. You know, Gaza is televised and it should be. That's the more pressing and that's the more urgent. But the small things, you know, and you speak to your families or old people. And I said, I remember I was speaking to a lady. She sold me sabr. And I was eating sabr and I asked her. And she said, this is the first time I'm able to come out because I'm usually not allowed access and I don't sit here and whatever. So then you really understand how deeply entrenched the occupation is.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on something very important. We can't romanticize the reality of what it is today. As much as we yearn for a piece of it, as much as we yearn for a memory, something that we can cling on to that represents belonging in some way, we can't romanticize what the reality is. And I find that every single time I talk to someone who is living in Palestine, there's a sadness, there's a heaviness, and I feel like there's a big responsibility on my part to listen. You know, as much as I want to do, it is not on me to dictate. I think they've had the mic taken away from them enough with what they've had to endure, and it's our turn to actually listen to what it is that they want and facilitate help in a way that enables them. How can we move forward? How can we move forward as Palestinians in exile and support our cause? What are some concrete steps we can start taking?
I mean, I think we talked about how we have to keep the momentum going in terms of educating, raising awareness, amplifying Palestinian voices. I mean, that's first and foremost. The baseline is the occupation needs to end. Mm-hmm. And even though we're presently the ceasefire.
Absolutely.
And that's let's say, al-qa'imi, the first thing that needs to happen. The other part of that is, you know, you start to realize that actually they can exist in the confines of the occupation. There is still business that is conducted. There is still human behavior that happens, like I was telling you before. You know, they want to have relationships. They go through divorces. They want to go to the cinema. They want to play football. They have human issues that people forget about. But then how do we connect with those human issues and bring them to light, you know, support businesses that are there? You know, the guy needs somebody to build his website. How is also us as people outside with our networks support them? If I know somebody who's an incredible poetry reader, why don't I try and help them find a way to express themselves or get their poetry out or do something? So there's still sort of an avenue where we can be a part of that. There's the immediate needs that we talk about in terms of addressing the occupation. A lot of it is more like awareness and a collective conscience, a collective power that can go and fix this and resolve it in the international and community in the global stage. But there is also the other human aspects of it, which is just how they navigate things from day to day, that they just hit a roadblock that's like, you know, I can't, you know, I wanted to travel, but I can't because I have this and this, or I don't have a visa, or I don't have. So how do we start to help and build up on those individual things? And I think that's where we can really amplify Palestinian lives, is just to give them the support that, and I think what you're doing is incredible in terms of having those conversations, but to support them at that sort of individual level or human level before we get to this, you know, in addition to the whole community, but to say, how can we connect this person with this person? If there's a, I was speaking to somebody and he was saying, you know, there's a whole cyber tech industry in Gaza that was, that existed before October 7. How do we get those sort of cyber specialists and competent programmers and web designers and coders into a space where we can give them day-to-day jobs? You know, they were being supported by Palestinian financial institutions. Those institutions now were under certain sanctions or restraints. But how can we lift them up and use them? And we all need some sort of tech support, you know, around the world. So how can we have that as a backbone? So it's, I think that it's just, how do we start to go from, while the external is important, why the whole bigger picture, and while Palestinian resources and amplifying Palestinian voices and this whole essence of solidarity, but also at the individual level, you know, why don't we pick one person and say, I'm going to take you with me through ever. I'm going to make sure you have all the resources, try and amplify you in social networks, professional networks, and bring you up. And if every other Palestinian bishitat in exile is to do that, we'll suddenly see we're elevating the next generation, where we're strong enough and we're equipped and we have the tools to sort of start to overcome this occupation.
I agree with you 100%. And I feel like, especially with everything that's happened since October, if anything, it has brought together communities of Palestinians from all over the world. And we are at a stage where, you know, we're meeting each other. We're meeting people from Palestine who were as, if not more, competent in terms of what they were able to do. They had businesses, they were entrepreneurs, they were cut off from funding, they were cut off from jobs, they were cut off from the outside community because of what has happened. So a large part of our responsibility is to almost create a web, literally, or an ecosystem of supporting and ala ultak, enabling them. Yeah. I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah, I'll just add to that. I mean, you know, and I use this, the Jews have this thing where they say, if one of them succeeds, he needs to take 10 with them.
That's beautiful.
I mean, there is that sense of community that they have. And mushkile, or some of the challenges that we see as Palestinians, there's a lot that gets in between us. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to, sure, like if we just focus before October 7, there is this victimhood that we do play. And for example, even with the clothing brand, or when I go to Ramallah and you say, oh, well, how about this? And, you know, the checkpoint is closed, for example. And it's like, we know the checkpoint is going to be closed. How can we navigate that? But it's very easy to regress and to feel that sort of inferiorness. And that's designed. That's designed by the occupation. We can't take that away from them, and we can't say that this is incorrect or whatever. But at least can we give them an alternative? Can we say, I'm going to pull you with me in this journey through the social network, amplify your lives, enable you to go on and to do more and to succeed?
Thank you for saying that, because I agree with you 100%. And I think this, I don't know what to call it, but this, I'm talking about the outside community, obviously, but as an outside community, assuming that there is no way around the difficulties of supporting and helping Palestinians, I think is just a cop-out. At this point, we live in a world where we have access to everything. So to cop out of helping in any way is unacceptable. When there's a will, there's a way. The challenge is making the choice and committing to that choice. And I've talked about that multiple times with regards to the cause and outside of the cause. You know, when I think about our heritage, especially now, because as you rightly mentioned, we have immediate needs that need to be met when it comes to Palestine. Medical aid, humanitarian aid, obviously a ceasefire, obviously the end to the genocide, and then in turn the occupation. We're starting to see a literal erasure of who we are actively happening. And it's so strange because I'm seeing it happen on my social media pages, and it feels like there's nothing I can do about it. You know, it's not even about appropriation of things that are part of our culture, our language, our food, our clothing, all of these things. It's a literal retelling of the truth of history. And I'm struggling to understand how to navigate this space. We were talking about it before the show. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I see it as two parts, right? The first part is desperation, fundamentally, right? That the whole world has sort of opened its eyes. And you look at social media accounts that have been sort of very dormant, let's say pre-genocide, and to suddenly turn around and absorb a lot of Palestinian history, almost amplify and talk about Palestinian rights more than other Palestinians or more than other parts of the world, right? So there is that uplifting support that's happening, and that in turn has led to this desperation from you know, the pro-Israeli Hasbara, the occupation, that whole agenda around, you know, this is our land, and that colonial theft. And that desperation is, well, how do we go back and erase more? And how do we go cancel more? And, you know, we haven't gone into this space yet. Let us try and exercise that. The other day, I was just very super curious, and I was reading about the Hasbara handbooks that were circulated and, you know, given to foreign ministers whenever they're ever asked a question about how Israel occupies and whatever, and what does it do? And it turns around and it says, always flip it into a positive. Always turn it into a positive thing. Like, oh yeah, well, we're taking care of this, or this is being done, or that's being done, whatever. But and if you think they've got to that level, that there's handbooks and there's propaganda that's going out there, there's denouncers of the Nakba that's happening, that's really a desperate move. That's like every other colonial movement that's happened around the world. Erasure of that identity is key, because you're basically saying the whole myth, the whole genesis of the state is now lying on where this identity and history came from. And if we can erase it, we can rewrite it. And so that's that. So it is a difficult place to navigate. And I think this is where it goes back to, how do we amplify our heritage and our support? The second part that I was going to say about this is that there's a sort of a test of time, like a strength that will show. And, you know, like what we were talking about, they've been trying to denounce the Nakba for ages. Now, as if we talk about sort of the Israeli society, there's Nakba sympathizers, and they sort of, yeah, it happened, sorry, there's nothing we can do about it. And then there's the deniers. And those have existed since 1948. And 75 years later, they're still not able to break this. That's where sort of the test of time, that's where really Jadurn, our identity, is so strong. And that's where the real facts are really strong. And that's where it keeps it up. So there's this whole sort of, they can't really topple this. They're desperate to topple it, but they can't really topple it because it's so strong, and it's factual, and it's right, and it's just, and it is true and pure. So they get more desperate, and because it's this, they can't do it, and then they get more desperate, and it's that cycle. And this is just, again, one of the so many tools that they try and use that continue to collapse on their heads. I mean, fundamentally, that exercise of trying to denounce the Nakba or trying to demystify it or whatever, the product is poor, you know, and that shows you how desperate they are as well.
You know, I heard something recently, which I found so, I can't believe I didn't know this, but did you know that the poppy plant was a symbol that was also used for resistance? I wasn't aware.
So I have a beautiful photo, maybe I'll show you after this, that I was in the Jordan Valley and close to Riha, Jericho, and it was beautiful springtime. And I took a photo of the poppy plant. I was like, oh my God, it's here. And it's growing indigenously on our land. Wow. And of course, that poppy has always been also a Palestinian symbol of our identity. The olive tree has always been a symbol of our identity, right? And that whole concept of its roots can run deep. Its survival in low water, poor soil conditions. It's these parallels that even through nature, our Palestinian identity is mimicking us as an identity. I go as far as to say, I mean, as we're talking about our steadfastness, our sumud and resistance, sort of on a touch of a mental health point as well, we always say that there's this intergenerational trauma that's coming through the Nakba. And there's starting to be a lot of research that is sort of confirming through the DNA strands, through our genetics, there is intergenerational trauma that's passed on. And I sort of challenge this as well. I say, if that's true, then why isn't resistance and steadfastness and sumud part of that genetic strand that's being handed on from generation to generation? We, in our bloodline, in our genetics, probably have the same sumud, the same resistance, the same resilience, the same strength as our forefathers did and our ancestors did, right? And there's that symmetry. We always think about this as a trauma, as a trauma, as a trauma. But also there's a strength and a resistance and an ancestry which is powerful, a lineage which allows us to connect to the land and be steadfast and strong whenever we need to be as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I agree. What a beautiful way to put it. I think that combined with, you know, one of the most beautiful things I've seen, and it was actually reaffirmed in a conversation that I had with Steve Sosaby, who's running an organization called Heal Palestine. He's been doing incredible work on ground for the past over 30 years in different ways. But he said, you know, one thing you can't take away from Palestinians is their humanity.
Yeah.
With everything that they've gone through, they stand strong and they're good people. They're good people.
Yeah. I mean, that's also another thing when we go back to what are your experiences of the land and like and how does it feel? I mean, straight away, I go into the old city of Jerusalem and they say, oh, where are you from? I say, Allah ghad, yani, you know, shayt al-sur. And they say, yalla, ahlo sahla, ahwa, shahai, whatever, whatever. And you say this hospitality, this like diyafe is really unique. It's very common around us as an Arab generation, but for people to have gone through what they have gone through, to be really challenged, backs up against the wall, probably in financial conditions which are not stable, to then turn around and say, "Inta arasi, tfaddal, ahlo sahla, albayt baytak," you know, that's powerful. And I think that's the beauty as well of our identity and of our culture. And we talk about how it's being challenged, but that exists within us. You know?
I mean, case in point.
Yeah.
Case in point. And it is delicious.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, though, the cane.
About the cane.
Tell me, there's a story there.
So the cane, there's two parts. I mean, the cane and the masbaha, the abaya, you know, there's two things. One is the whole concept of how do we carry our ancestors. And so my grandfather used to carry a cane. He was, certain things had happened to him and during his life, and he ended up carrying a cane. And when I was thinking of Ajdadi, the clothing, my clothing brand, and I was working on it and designing it, I really started to feel, especially, I also do my own tatriz. I learn how to do tatriz while I have a team based in Gaza who do a lot of the work on the ground there and as well to empower them as a social enterprise and community. I said, I need to learn tatriz the same way my grandmother was doing tatriz. I'd sit and I'd do it. But I started to think more and more, what would my grandmother, let's say, or her grandmother be thinking about when they're working on tatriz? What is going through their mind as they do tatriz? And I started to feel that I'm getting closer and closer with my ancestors, with my history, with Ajdadi. And that's why I started to say, they had a life, they had a style, they had a fashion, they had this anaqa, you know, this elegance, this glamour of how they would dress and speak and present themselves. I said, why don't I embody that as well? It's a beautiful thing. And if I was to see them today, I'd say, wow, what a vibe. So how do we carry that forward? How do we keep this legacy of, oh, there's a hajj with a stick sort of thing happening? The masbaha as well. I mean, from a religious context, of course, I used to use the masbaha. But then I started to look into it and my father started pulling up, here's your grandfather's masbaha. Here's the one I used to carry. And I was like, wow, there's so much symmetry before I even got to this space. So there's, again, it's this concept of symmetry and why not let it run through the ages and celebrate it and be bold and carry it? Started off as a joke, but then I turned around and said, you know, I really like it and I enjoy walking with it. As I said, with the kufiyya, it makes me walk, you know, a little couple of centimeters higher every day.
You made me want to end the episode with my kufiyya lahsa and
habisa. وهاي كوفية محترمة فيها باب as well.
شايف؟
Yeah.
Only
so
that, the best.
So that's also it as well. Like I you know, as we continue to educate people, why, for example, does the kufiya have ihbab on it, make it thicker in winter and not winter? Why were we wearing it during winter months? How would we wear it during winter months versus not? You know, that sort of stuff. And those are small key differences that when we talk about our history and our identity and our heritage, it can continue and it can go on, which is important. But it's the subtle things that I think. You know, the devil is in the detail. And how do we keep those details alive?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, on that note, I think this is the beginning of a lot of conversations that we're going to be having with each other. And I think with our community, you've given us so much to consider. I usually end episodes with a question where I ask my guest if there's something that they would want me to consider, or if there is a question that you want to ask me.
I mean, I think what you're like, it's more of a statement. I think you allowing Palestinians and others, friends and family of Palestine, to also be part of these podcasts is incredible. And it shows also how diverse we are in our spaces, and, you know, meeting in a common event where we're talking about this, and you've been setting up podcasts. So power to you. Allah wafik, and inshallah you can continue to do more, and I look forward to having more conversations with you.
Thank you.
But as the question goes, how's the Mirami?
It's absolutely هي الشاي.
شاي yeah. بس بدها طبخ كمان بدها
بدها شوي بس it's okay.
It
works.
Needs معمول وعجله.
أيوة.
This is for next time.
For next time. Yep. I think, yeah, for sure we're going to do this.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Honestly, you're such a, what an incredible opportunity to have met you. And I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to, you know, I wish the circumstances were different, but I'm so grateful for the Palestinian community that has emerged from what is going on. I pray for better days.
Yeah, inshallah. And of course, I mean, and of course, we all pray for a ceasefire, and that's the next step. And then that's not just the end. That's actually the beginning of how do we rebuild and come together as a people, rebuild the whole structure. But yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. It's an absolute honor for me to be here with you. And hopefully many more to come, inshallah.
Inshallah. And to our audience, thank you so much for listening. As always, thank you for the privilege of your time. We hope you found something to consider. You have such a beautiful energy.
Thank you very
Mashallah
much.
Mashallah alaik.
Thank you.
Honestly, it's contagious. Did you guys stop smiling? I can't stop smiling. I can't stop smiling.
For me, it's more like, you know, when somebody's passion just seeps through.
Yeah.
You can't help but get like so enamored and so like involved in everything that they're saying.
Mm. It's an exuded love.
And I can. For allowing me to sit in.
Habibti.
Thank you for letting me stay.
I love that. People
thank
are excited.
Thank you for guys filming this.
Literally, thank you for being here. The fact that you guys wanted to be here for this episode is a privilege.
I told Kat last time, next time Dana's booking, I want to be there for her session.
I love that. You guys.
Next time we bring you guys tea.
Hey,
we can't have you guys sat there dry throats, not enjoying this Mirami.
I'm so grateful for you guys. Thank you.
I mean, like, I could go on. There's so much to talk about when we even go into things like Ajdadi and why Ajdadi is the way it is and how it's designed and what we're doing. And
why
how.
Ajdadi is the way it is. Tell us more. We have a few minutes.
Why? How do I go into Ajdadi? So yeah, as I was saying, I mean, as a social enterprise, there's two parts of Ajdadi. One is Ajdadi, the second part is the collective. So the full brand is called Ajdadi Collective. Ajdadi in its most core form is celebrating Palestinian identity and heritage through Tatri streetwear. Now as a collective, connecting wearers and wearers and makers together in a network of embroiderers that exist across Palestine. As a collective, as a solidarity, all coming together and being able to share the solidarity, whether you're from Palestine or from outside Palestine, how does the message resonate with you? And through the design of the Tatris, I actually, each t-shirt has its own story, the same way it used to have back in the days of certain Athwab. There's other smaller details. I mean, the Ajdadi logo is an olive branch. Of course, all of the olive trees that we harvest now, some of them were planted by our ancestors, some of them were harvested by our ancestors. The Ajdadna bil-ard, ka shajar zaytoun jadur amiqa, is the deeply rooted is the Ajdadi logo slogan that connects again the roots that can run deep into the ground, but also our history and our identity rooted into the land of Palestine. So it's this full sort of eclipse on everything that is connected from our identity, our heritage, our steadfastness, our ancestry, and all of us coming together. The story of Ajdadi isn't just about Zach's story of his grandparents that used to do Tatris. It's your parents, Dana's Ajdad, that used to come together as a collective. So all of that, and how do we keep that legacy of Tatris going while being able to gratefully support and amplify Palestinian communities and the embroiderers and the ladies who are working on it. So that's also the other aspect of it. To take you through some of the t-shirts and the designs, it's incredibly rich as a symbol of why these have come together, the story, the messaging that we want to share as Tatriz did in back in the day.
I'll definitely be passing by and adding some supplementary content about that, because I think there's a lot of beautiful angles to that. Just to clarify, when you say that it connects back, all of your pieces made in Palestine?
So let's say pre-October 7, everything was made in Gaza.
Okay.
And I had a team of embroiderers who were based in Gaza who used to do everything. Mm. Now, the focus is that the embroidery continues to be handmade. So right now, obviously, post-genocide, I'm trying to navigate how do I do that, whether I'm using embroiderers now, some from Gaza, some, let's say, from Jerusalem, some from the West Bank, some from different areas of the West Bank, the different refugee camps, potentially even refugees, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon or in Jordan. But again, that's that compass of a collective coming mm-hmm. together. And how do we all have this sort of shared ambition of amplifying our identity? But yeah, it used to be fully made end-to-end in Gaza.
Is there any way that we can support you?
Right now, I mean, previously I had done a silent auction for one of the sneakers. So also combining, you know, the concept of the sneakers, I made it almost for myself as a sneakerhead. Combining sort of fashion and culture has always been a big thing. When you put on a t-shirt, you have an identity to represent, an ability to represent. I want that identity or representation to be through Tatriz. So I pushed it further. I did it for the sneakers and, you know, I'm wearing them now. But those sneakers, I had done a silent auction on them during Real Palestine and all the proceeds were being donated to my team. I will probably do another one. So do look out for it on the Ajdadi Instagram. But right now, I mean, I'm trying to connect with some of the ladies that I used to work with and embroider with. Some days we hear from them, some days we don't. Of course, there's a lot of martyrs. The factory destroyed, everything destroyed. Doesn't compare to the loss of human life. And Ajdadi will be rebuilt the same way Gaza will be rebuilt, inshallah.
Inshallah. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you very much.
And as always, we hope you found something to consider.